Imagine, if you will, England, the 1580s. Dr. John Dee, a mathematician, astronomer, and advisor to Queen Elizabeth I, peers into his mirror, a polished obsidian surface slightly warped, seeking nothing short of the divine.
And at his side, Edward Kelly, an enigmatic alchemist shrouded in both scandal and incredulity, fervently transcribing messages conveyed during scrying sessions. They claimed these communications were from angels, celestial intelligences adept in an ancient and sacred language.
This language would become known, centuries later, as Enochian. But their partnership was, well, peculiar. Dee, the scholar, structured and meticulous. Kelly, impulsive, almost wild. Their dynamic unravelled three distinct phases of work. Heptarchia Mystica, Lower Gaeth, and finally, Enochian.
Now, Heptarchia. Mystica, yes, the name alone has a delightful ring to it, was their foundational phase. Angelic kings and princes, planetary alignments, intricate layers of symbology. But it wasn't until Logaeth and Enochian proper that we see their work transcend, quite literally, into new realms of thought.
Indeed, their Enochian sessions focused on unlocking the ethers, 30 cascading levels of consciousness or spiritual planes. It was as if they were forging a stairway to heaven itself, each whisper from an angel, another stone on the pathway.
You know, Jessica, I had the chance to visit the British Library recently to view some of Dee's original manuscripts. They've preserved much of his spirit diaries, the foundation of what we know about their communications. Standing there, amidst his pages filled with grids and sigils, the ink just faintly faded. You could almost feel the weight of it all.
The energy must have been intoxicating. Those symbols, those words, they aren't mere relics. They're alive in a way, carried forward by the curiosity of every person who dares decipher their mysteries.
Absolutely. The notes combined meticulous record-keeping with a sense of wonder. I couldn't help but marvel at the layers of computation and devotion wrapped into his every line. It makes one wonder. Did he ever fully grasp what he was channeling?
Perhaps the system, Barry, wasn't meant to be fully understood. Not even by Dee himself. Mysteries like this, they demand to remain tempting, tantalizing, just out of reach. That is their allure.
And tantalizing is the perfect word for it. This journey through the Enochian period, it's transformed not only Dee and Kelly, but esotericism as we know it today. I imagine it felt to them as though they were brushing up against something vast, infinite.
And what of Kelly, I wonder? Peering into those scrying mirrors, passing those words along, he must have felt moments of overwhelming clarity or unspeakable terror.
Well, one thing's for sure. Whatever they invoked, their work laid the foundation for centuries of speculative and practical magic. And the Enochian language? Oh, it would prove pivotal, not just then, but in adapting magical practices for generations to come. Jessica, I can't help but marvel at how their celestial communications spilled over into something so tangible, these remarkable physical tools. Take the Holy Table, for example. It's a 12x7 grid, intricate beyond belief, laden with the names of angels and planetary forces, perfectly embodying that blend of divine significance and meticulous human craftsmanship their work relied upon.
Yes, the Holy Table. There's something haunting about its description. Letters aligning, almost alive, whispering brilliance and secrets locked in wood. And from there, the Sigillum Dei Amith, so delicate, yet so potent.
Absolutely. This waxen tablet, sculpted with divine numbers and sigils, is the very centre of Dee's angelic operations. And yet, I wonder, does its magic lie in the symbols, or in the belief we imbue in them?
Perhaps it's both. I once used a sigillum replica during a ritual. You'll laugh at this. But as the candle flickered, its flame suddenly extinguished. The room fell into silence, palpable and thick, as though something unseen had entered.
That gives me chills. These tools, so alive in the moment, seem to channel something profound. But then, fast forward a few centuries to the Golden Dawn, and we see reinterpretations, don't we? They took these tools, the Holy Table, even the Lamen itself, and dare I say, moulded them into something new.
Yes, a reimagining that diluted as much as it preserved. The layman, Barry, it's like a mirror of the Holy Table, designed to draw celestial power directly upon the practitioner. But when Aleister Crowley got his hands on it, I feel it transformed into a broader vehicle for his own eclectic vision.
And that's something I think about often. When these magicians adapted Dee's work, did they enhance it? Or lose some intangible, raw connection to the divine itself? It's as though the system was distilled down to fit different frameworks, and something might have slipped through the cracks.
You know, such tools are more than artifacts or channels of power. Perhaps they serve as tiny windows, framing glimpses of the ethers or what lies beyond. Do you ever think their structure mirrors a greater cosmic design?
That would explain so much. Every symbol, every name, feels purposeful, almost mathematical in its precision. Like the angels themselves carefully constructed a bridge between our world and theirs, leaving behind these tangible, puzzle-like markers for us to follow.
A bridge, yes. Yet one that tests. These tools, these symbols, they seem to demand a reverence, a synchronization with some higher frequency. I often wonder, Barry, what it would take, truly, to cross such a bridge without slipping into the void.
That makes me think of modern echoes of these practices. Today, in quiet rooms, people create their own holy tables, their own mirrors, calling out for what could never truly be known. And yet, in those whispers, they hope to find something akin to revelation.
The echoes, the whispers, whether from handcrafted sigils or polished obsidian, they endure, Barry. Such mysteries, it seems, are always watching us, even as we gaze into their depths. Barry, speaking of those whispers and echoes, imagine stepping into shadowed halls lit only by candles, the air heavy with incense. At the centre, much like Kelly and Dee, stands a man surrounded by an aura of deep mysticism, Mr. Warner of the Crimson Pillar Spiritualist Society. He claimed to call forth the ethers using mirrors of polished obsidian, crafting his own bridge to the unseen.
The parallels are striking. Although Warner's methods are somewhat modernized, there's a clear echo of Enochian practice in his rituals, right down to the chants and geometric diagrams reminiscent of the elemental tablets. I mean, these ethers, 30 realms of consciousness or spiritual reality, they're almost identical in concept.
Indeed. And yet, Barry, something about Warner the air crackling during his rituals, whispered voices that seem to emanate from nowhere. Tell me, how do we reconcile what happened one fateful evening, when he simply vanished into thin air?
Ah, yes, that account. Anthony Bridges, his former associate, described the moment in vivid detail. Warner at the centre of a ritual circle, reciting the final incantation. And then, nothing. One moment there, the next. Gone. And the aftermath?
The witness receiving a phone call, Barry. Hearing that Warner had seemingly appeared miles away, disoriented as though ejected from reality itself. Such an occurrence, it defies reason. Or does it?
It makes you wonder, doesn't it? Could his ritual have truly opened a door into the ethers and then flung him back out? During my research, I found eerie similarities in archival accounts, misaligned scrying attempts leading to sudden disorientations, even transportation. It paints a broader picture of consciousness exploration that aligns remarkably with what Dee and Kelly documented.
And here we see the pattern repeat across centuries. A kind of echo. How curious, this blend of vision, belief, and possibly science we cannot yet fathom. Barry, it was never about merely reaching the divine, was it?
No. It's about brushing up against something vast and inexplicable. These practices, whether Mr. Warner's or Dee's, aren't just exercises in ritual. They challenge the boundaries of what is real, what is knowable.
Which is perhaps why they remain so alluring. Barry, think of Dee's obsidian mirror, Warner's polished glass. Every gesture, every word spoken into those depths. It's humanity searching, asking, what else is there?
What indeed? And Jessica, maybe, just maybe, those whispers in the mirrors aren't only echoes of what we want to hear. They're answers waiting, daring us to ask the right questions.
Perhaps, Barry. Mysteries such as these, whether divine or etheric, they watch. Quietly, ceaselessly. And as we gaze into their abyss, who's to say they aren't gazing back?
And that's the curiosity of it all, Jessica. I suppose, at the heart of it, this all reminds me why we began exploring, both them and us. It isn't about answers, really. It's about that relentless urge to seek, even when the questions themselves elude us.
And on that note, Barry, perhaps it is fitting we leave our listeners here. Questions may linger and mysteries endure, but oh, how they beckon, don't they?
Perfectly said, Jessica. And to our listeners, let these echoes stay with you until next time, wherever your paths through the unseen take you.